International sanctions try to stop Iran from profiting on its oil, but Iranian tankers are still making deliveries.
The sanctions are placed on the people buying the oil. So there's really nothing that prevents Iran from putting oil in tankers and shipping it out of the Persian Gulf.
Today on The World, how Iran continues to sell oil. Also, after-school programs try to steer kids away from being radicalized, but the programs have mostly one kind of kid in mind.
If you're a young Muslim, you realize I'm only getting this because the Department of Homeland Security thinks that I'm a potential terrorist.
But what about white supremacists? And a few words about the word the. Nobody can trademark the word the, right? I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. After 6 weeks, a captured oil tanker is free to sail on. On July 4th, the British seized an Iranian tanker in Gibraltar, a UK territory. The British suspected that the ship was violating European sanctions and delivering oil to Syria. But the UK government says it's now been reassured that oil will not be going to Syria, and so the ship is heading out to sea. There's another ship we need to mention, too, a British ship that Iran seized in an apparent tit-for-tat. No progress there. Despite a range of crippling sanctions, oil from Iran does get around the world. And we wondered, how does that work? Ellen Wald helps us unpack the confusing rules of sanctions at sea. She's a specialist in the energy trade and author of Saudi Inc.
One of the things to understand about the sanctions is that the sanctions are placed on the customers, the people buying the oil. So there's really nothing that prevents Iran from putting oil in tankers and shipping it out of the Persian Gulf, except it needs a customer, it needs a final destination. And so one of the things that the sanctions have done is they've eliminated a lot of Iran's customers because countries and different refineries don't want to be identified as purchasing Iranian oil because then they will be subject to sanctions. So that cut out a fairly large portion of Iran's oil trade, but not the entire thing. And Iran has really developed some fairly sophisticated measures to get around the fact that its customers, the ones it still has, don't want to be identified.
So given all that, who are the major buyers of Iranian oil?
Right now, Iran's primary buyer is China.
So give us a little geography lesson. Describe the route of Iranian oil to China.
The first thing that happens is that oil has to be loaded onto tankers in the Persian Gulf. And oftentimes when that oil is loaded onto a tanker, the tanker won't display where it's going. Now, typically, all ships and tankers use something called an AIS transponder, which is a satellite transponder that shows, it broadcasts, you know, what it's carrying, how much it's carrying, and where it's going. But tankers that Iran is using just shut those transponders off. In fact, the entire fleet basically turns them off. It's called going blind.
And is that legal? Can they do that?
Well, legal and illegal is an interesting question. If a regular tanker were to do that, they would essentially void their insurance policy, and that would be very bad, particularly if the tanker that no one can see on the satellite then crashes into something.
Okay, next stop for the Iranian oil en route to China.
So then it's got to actually get out of the Persian Gulf. And the way that you get out of the Persian Gulf is you go through the Strait of Hormuz, which is a narrow waterway where Iranian and Omani or UAE territory meets.
And so what's their next stop?
Sometimes they'll actually offload cargo in Malaysia, which would then be picked up by someone else, or sometimes they'll do ship-to-ship transfers, which is this really technical thing where another ship will come up alongside the tanker and they will transfer oil or whatever product they're carrying from one ship to the other, and then that ship might take it up into the Chinese port. And the ship-to-ship transfers make it even more difficult to track this oil because once that oil is going onto, say, maybe three different ships, and they often will only transfer part of their cargo, it becomes even more difficult to track.
And so that oil then, if it's separated onto several ships, then those ships proceed on to whatever Chinese ports they're going to.
Exactly.
Who are other big buyers of Iranian oil?
So Syria is really the only other significant customer at this time. And getting to Syria is a little more difficult because you either have to go through the Suez Canal, which is a choke point where oil can be stopped, or you've got to go other ways to get there.
So Iran can sell oil to Syria?
There's no actual embargo. There's no navy at the gates of the Persian Gulf stopping tankers from leaving. So it really all depends on whether either you want to physically stop a tanker like the British did with the tanker that was near Gibraltar, or if you can sanction the receiving party. And the problem with sanctioning the Syrian government is that they're not paying attention to any sanctions. So the transport of oil to Syria has definitely been cut down, but they are still getting some shipments through.
Ellen Wald is a specialist in the energy trade, and she's the author of Saudi Inc. Thanks a lot, Ellen.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
The seized Iranian ship was in Gibraltar, a British territory off the coast of Spain. Spain's government isn't getting much done these days. The socialists won the most seats in Spanish elections back in April, but it's a parliamentary system there, and negotiations to form a new coalition government are at a standstill. The socialists campaigned on the so-called ecological transition, moving away from coal and toward clean energy. People have been mining in Spain's northern region of Asturias for 150 years, but the industry is almost dead. They were looking to the socialists for hope and new green jobs. But as Lucia Benavides reports, hope is on hold.
It's 2 p.m, and dozens of miners, mostly young men, are walking out of the San Nicolas coal mine in a hurry to get home and eat lunch. The underground mine is located in a valley surrounded by lush green hills. At its peak, the mine employed around 2,000 people. Today, about 200 work here. One of the miners leaving his morning shift is Gorka Peña. He's 36 and has been working at San Nicolas for 9 years.
Mi padre trabajaba en el lavadero del Batán.
He says his father was also a miner. He didn't expect to end up in the trade himself. San Nicolás is the last working coal mine in all of Spain.
Aquí ni ves futuro, ni hay juventud, cada vez.
Peña says there's no future here, no youth. There are more retirees than working people. And Peña says the younger generations are leaving the region or even Spain to find jobs. Many of those I spoke to say they just want work so they can stay, and it doesn't have to be in a coal mine. Last October, the leading mining union struck a deal with Spain's socialist government to funnel 220 million euros into the region over the next decade. José Luis Alperi is the union spokesperson.
En Asturias, lo que pedimos y lo que necesitamos es que
what we're asking for and what we need is for this ecological transition to be exactly what it says it is. That is, that no one be left behind.
Alperi is cautiously optimistic. The union has struck deals with the Spanish government in the past, both liberal and conservative parties. But Alperi says they broke their promises. They haven't invested in the region. Retired miner Fredo Oviña is skeptical of the Spanish governments, past and present. He sits at a cafe with 3 other friends, drinking afternoon beers in the mining town of San Martin. Oviña says a lot of the money supposed to go towards investing in new industries in the region has been badly handled.
No es pragmático la formación que quieren hacer, no es práctica.
He says the type of job opportunities the Spanish government has promised aren't practical. There are no new green energy jobs, he adds. That's because there's been no actual transition away from fossil fuels.
El tema es económico-político.
It's an economic and political issue, Oviña tells me. In Spain, by law, miners have to be paid a living wage with benefits, which brings the price of coal up. But, Oviña says, Spain continues to import coal from other countries where it's much cheaper. Environmental activist Fructuoso Pontigo says that's right.
Se cerraron las minas asturianas.
All the mines in Asturias have closed, but we continue to import coal. It's kind of a contradiction, no?
Pontigo estimates that 80% of the coal burned in Asturias power plants is imported from foreign countries. The region is among Europe's dirtiest, producing vast amounts of carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. Many of the miners I met in Asturias say they've seen signs that things were moving forward under the socialists. But again, without a majority, their new government is stalled. And the miners are stuck waiting and wondering if government promises will be different this time. Back at the cafe, the retired miners continue drinking beer and talking about their history of unionizing. Ángeles Rubio breaks into an old mining song about the region's patron saint.
Mira, Marusina, mira, mira y cómo vengo yo.
Rubio starts tearing up as she sings. It's a song her father, who was a miner, used to whistle as he got ready for work.
La mina fue muy dura.
Rubio says life at the coal mine was difficult, but many people were able to live a good life, and the mines shaped the identity of the town. Now, she tells me as she points to the town's empty streets, there are barely any young people around. She says she sees the future of Asturias as dark as the color of coal. For The World, I'm Lucia Benavides in Asturias, Spain.
Here's something you don't hear often at the dinner table. Hey, why don't we buy the world's largest island? That's what President Trump reportedly keeps asking his advisors. He wants to buy Greenland. Sorry, Mr. President, Greenland says it's not for sale. The autonomous country within the Kingdom of Denmark, yes, Denmark is a kingdom, is not on the market. But why Greenland? Well, it has a lot to offer. Here to tell us more about it is Paul Krarup, the news editor at Sermitsiak, a newspaper in Greenland. Paul, first of all, what was your reaction when you heard that President Trump was interested in buying Greenland?
Unbelievable. It was so funny to hear that.
Why do you think Trump would want to buy Greenland?
I'm not sure I can take it serious. I don't think that he means that. I think that he means that he wants to collaborate closer with Greenland. I think it's the wrong word that he used, because who's going to sell it? I mean, nobody owns Greenland. He can talk with the Greenlanders, yes, about collaboration and so on, as equal partners, but who should sell Greenland? Denmark can't sell Greenland. Denmark doesn't own Greenland.
President Trump is scheduled to visit Denmark in September to meet with the country's new prime minister,
yes,
Mette Frederiksen. He's also supposed to meet Greenland's premier, Kim Kielsen. Are Greenlanders now a little bit more curious about what's going to happen at that meeting?
Of course, the focus will be on the Arctic. The focus will be on geopolitics in the Arctic, China and Russia. And the focus will be on how Greenland and the United States can collaborate. All the years, we have been looking for the United States to help us with air routes between the United States and Greenland. The market is not big enough to go on private business, so we have to have subsidies from the government to run an airplane.
You want American tourists, but you can't get them unless there's more direct flights between the U.S. and Greenland, is that it?
Yes, and we would like our people to go to America. We want our students to go to universities in the United States.
I have to ask about climate change, because it's an issue that really affects Greenland. How big of a concern is it at this point?
It's a very big concern, because it is the climate change is changing the Greenlandic society.
The melting ice in Greenland, the irony, of course, is that as it melts, it will make access to a lot of natural resources possible. I mean, Greenland has vast quantities of metals and energy resources. Are people in Greenland talking about kind of that's a good thing, actually, that they can mine those things?
Yes, we are. And we are developing new mining industries. And I think that is also why Trump is interested in Greenland.
Paul, what do you want people to know about Greenland?
It is the most developed Arctic country. We have a modern society, and we have Greenlandic language, Greenlandic culture, very Greenlandic society. We like Americans to come here and visit us.
Paul Krarup is the news editor at Sermitsiak, a newspaper in Greenland. Paul, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, President Trump says U.S. factories are roaring back. Are they? You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. When President Trump ran for office, a major part of his campaign was a promise to bring back American manufacturing. Over and over and over, Trump said that factory jobs that went overseas would return to the U.S. under a Trump presidency. Yesterday, speaking in New Hampshire, the president took a bow for getting things done.
Before the election, our factories were closing. Hey, who knows it better than you? You're like central casting for the closing of factories. Our jobs were vanishing.
But have manufacturing jobs indeed come back home, as Trump often claims? Joining me now is Harry Moser, the founder of the Reshoring Initiative, which works to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. So how's the U.S. doing on that?
The U.S. has done extremely well. We started the Reshoring Initiative in 2010, and in that year, about 7,000 manufacturing jobs were announced coming back. That rose to 188,000 in 2017, driven by tax and regulatory cuts, dropped off a bit to 145,000 in 2018, but still 20 times as many as in 2010. So overall, the trend has been very strong. The trend preceded President Trump, but it so far has definitely had its highest rate under President Trump.
So are there specific things that the Trump administration has done that have made bringing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. easier? I mean, can he be credited for some of this?
Yes. The tax and regulatory cuts, which were passed in 2017 but were anticipated with his election, we saw a definite surge in announcements of jobs upon his election, and then an extremely strong 2017. So no question, the tax and regulatory cuts made a difference. Companies saw their return on investment significantly improved by having lower tax rates in the U.S. and therefore came here instead of elsewhere. We've talked to companies that have said we were going to get there someday. We came now because of the tax cuts.
Give us a sense of what the state of U.S. manufacturing looks like today as opposed to, say, a decade ago.
If you did a trend line from 20 years ago till 10 years ago and you extended it, we have about 3 million more manufacturing jobs than if that trend had continued. So we're doing much better than somebody 10 years ago would have forecast. A lot of the trend has been due to Chinese wages going up rapidly, going up 10 to 15% per year, starting about 15, 17 years ago. So their costs, their prices have gone up significantly relative to ours, and therefore it's less profitable to source in China than here. As a result, about 60% of the reshoring has been from China.
Your organization is called the Reshoring Initiative, and you're trying to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. What do you actually do in order to bring them back?
We're a not-for-profit. On our website, we have a variety of tools that can help companies or states accelerate reshoring and foreign direct investment. So, for example, the total cost of ownership estimator helps companies do the math correctly, so they see that perhaps buying in Massachusetts for 10 is more profitable than buying in China for 8 when you put all the other costs that are the logistics and the delays and the quality and the intellectual property risk, everything else into it.
Harry Moser is the founder of the Reshoring Initiative, which works to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. Thanks a lot, Harry.
I appreciate the opportunity.
It's not just the United States that's been having some trade tensions. There's a lot of ill will between Japan and South Korea right now. It's partly about trade, but for South Korea, it's also rooted in their resentment over Japanese colonial rule. Many are so furious with Japan right now, they're boycotting Japanese products and stores. Kelly Kasulis reports from Seoul.
I'm heading to my local 7-Eleven, just outside of Seoul.
안녕하세요.
Convenience stores like these are usually full of people at this hour, coming in to buy beer and snacks. But right now, it's just me and the store owner, Lee Sang-jun. Lee is Korean, and so is his privately owned 7-Eleven franchise. But many South Koreans think his store is actually Japanese. And that's far from good news. Thousands of South Koreans are currently boycotting Japanese stores and products.
브랜드 때문에 그리고 인터넷에
So the word has been spread on the internet that like 7-Eleven is associated with Japan and a lot of Japanese products. So certain customers have come in to like complain that they don't want to see Japanese products in the store.
The Japan boycott started in early July, after Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe issued export restrictions on chemicals commonly sold to South Korea. Big Korean tech companies like LG and Samsung use these chemicals to make phone parts and display screens. Japan said the restrictions were for national security reasons, But South Koreans don't buy that. They think Tokyo is retaliating against Korea. That's after Korea's Supreme Court recently ordered a Japanese company to pay reparations to survivors of Japan's forced labor campaign. Japan brutally colonized Korea from 1910 to 1945, and feelings are still bitter. Lee says his sales of Japanese products dropped by 50% since July.
우선은 협력 업체들. 네. 그리고
So anyone who's still carrying the Japanese products would see some kind of decline in their sales.
In downtown Seoul, things are heating up even more. Thousands marched through Gwangmun Square in the rain on Korea's Liberation Day, the 74th anniversary of Japan's withdrawal from Seoul.
It's pouring rain and everyone's out here in like plastic bags, smocks, just to protest. It's hard to even walk because it's like the war of umbrellas.
Outside of the palace gates, I meet a protester named Lee Sang-eun, who says she threw her own money away over these boycotts.
저는 실제로 여행을 가기로 했다가
I was supposed to go on a trip to Japan, but I canceled that. And Japanese liquor such as Asahi Beer and Daiso, little brands like that, I've been boycotting them.
I reached out to several Japanese businesses, but no one would speak to me about the boycotts. So I went to see for myself how they're affecting one iconic Japanese store. So I'm walking through a Uniqlo in downtown Seoul right now, and I don't see a single customer. Like, I don't even see a worker. Outside of the Uniqlo, I met Cho Young-suk, who says she's against the boycotts.
그냥... 저는 일본 제품도 좋은 거 많이 쓰고 있거든요, 사실.
I see no personal reason to participate in the boycott, as a lot of Japanese products are very useful and efficient. I think past is the past. Korea's history with Japan, it should be put aside. And since our economy is going on a very, gone a downfall in a rapid rate, I think it's smarter for us to stand for our economy rather than just boycott based on emotional feeling.
But emotions are running high. Back at my neighborhood 7-Eleven, even the owner, Lee Sang-jun, says he's not buying Japanese products in his day-to-day life.
이 불매 운동이 좀 오래 갈 거라고 생각합니다.
He says he thinks the boycotts will go on for a while, and he says after he sells off his remaining stock, he won't carry Japanese products anymore. For the World, Kelly Kasulis, Seoul.
Vladimir Putin took power in Russia 20 years ago today. How long will he stay in power?
Well, the external audiences tend to personalize Russian political system into one single name, into one single face.
Beyond Putin. I'm Carol Hills. That's next on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH in Boston, PRI and PRX. For you regular listeners out there, you've heard us building up to this moment. Today marks 20 years, officially, since Vladimir Putin took office as Russia's prime minister. He's now, of course, Russia's president, serving his fourth term. He took a break in the middle, serving as prime minister. In the U.S., that couldn't happen. The 22nd Amendment, passed in 1947, limits a U.S. president to two terms. Total. In Russia, you can't serve for more than two consecutive terms. So in 2024, Putin has to step aside. That is, unless things change.
We have various possible scenarios for surmounting the so-called problem 2024, if there is a problem.
That's Russian political scientist Ekaterina Shulman. It's still 4 years away, but Russians are already asking, what will Putin do in 2024? My colleague Marco Werman spoke with Shulman about that.
I want to get to the what's next for Putin question in a moment, but we're catching you at a really interesting time in Russia. Russian citizens have been out in the streets protesting for several weekends in a row. What has led to this, what seems like a sudden burst of civic activism?
Nothing could be more natural than this current state of public opinion in Russia. Starting, I would say, 2016, we have the growing discontent and anxiety and lower trust ratings of all the public figures, all the political status quo in general. And it is because of, again, the most natural of factors, the worsening economic situation. Now, with this general sea change in people, opinions, what they want from the power, what they want from the establishment, and what they actually get, almost anything can become the reason for this protest activity.
So that gets us to the question looming over Russian society, what's next for Putin? What's next for Russia? His term ends in 2024. What, though, are some of the possible scenarios you see?
There is a possibility of a change in constitution. You can just eliminate this small phrase about two terms in a row. Then there's the successor scenario, the one that has been realized by the current president in 2008, when for 4 years, the then prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, became the president. There's the generally discussed idea of changes that would empower the parliament and in this way to diffuse the powers currently enjoyed by the incumbent. This is what can be approximately called the Kazakhstan scenario. Then there was the so-called Belarusian idea. So the president of Russia can become the president of Russian-Belarusian Union and in this way surmount the obstacle of two terms in a row. So we have quite a palette of possible variants.
I've noticed, though, that you have not yet mentioned one scenario that there are tons of examples of all over the world where a head of state stays beyond the constitutional limit of power, and that pushes people into the streets in the hundreds of thousands, well beyond what we're seeing with the current protests in Moscow.
So I have listed all these scenarios, but these were the peacetime scenarios. Mm. Now, if we really have underestimated the degree of public discontent, then we may have things moving quicker. And this very movement may be emerging before our very eyes.
Whether or not Putin stays in power in 2024, in the background, what other big changes or trends are underway that could affect the future and Putin's own fortunes?
Economic situation first and foremost. From my point of view, Russia is more important to itself than any other country is important to her. So this first, whether we have a more positive economic dynamics or we stay in this stagnation phase and people get poorer and poorer and poorer.
Finally, I mean, you know this better than anybody else. With many periods of Russian history, there's a lot of unpredictability, just like now. But based on what you've been seeing, are you optimistic that Russia could be heading in a more democratic direction, that the Russian president in 2024 could be someone that is not Putin, that is actually a Putin opponent?
I wouldn't predict not just the results of presidential elections of 2024, but even their very existence. But I must say that historically, in the medium term, there is hardly an alternative to step-by-step democratization. We have this urbanized country with 74.4% of people living in the cities, in towns, almost 100% literacy, more than a half of the people having education higher than school education. With such a society, there can hardly be another dynamics than, again, gradual and non-linear democratization.
And personally for you, as a Russian citizen, not as a political scientist, where do you see hope?
Well, I'm also a teacher. I teach legislative process in the Russian Presidential Academy. So I see people aged 20 and a little younger and a little older. So I cannot help admiring the new generation. The young people of Russia are beautiful. They are educated. They are intelligent. Sometimes they do not know things that they were supposed to know, but they know how to seek information. And their skills of communication are admirable. So anyone who has to do on a regular basis with the younger people can't help having great hopes for the Russia's future.
Ekaterina Shulman, speaking with us from Moscow. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Ekaterina Shulman is a political scientist based in Moscow, speaking there with the world's Marco Werman. Here's a difficult question that governments across the world have to grapple with. How to combat violent extremism? In 2011, the Obama administration thought they had a solution. They designed programs to engage communities, providing grants for mentoring programs and teacher training. The approach was met with praise and criticism. And now, budget cuts. Fatma Ahmed is the deputy director of the Muslim Justice League in Boston, and she has some strong feelings about the program to counter violent extremism.
So what's wrong with them is that whole idea that somebody has, you know, radical beliefs and that leads to violence, it's not real. And if you actually read, you know, literature from people who are doing countering violent extremism type programs, you'll often find actually a disclaimer about the fact that there is no way to actually predict who will commit an act of violence. That's one piece of it. The other part of it is who gets to define what a radical belief is or who has, you know, an extreme ideology. And the way that that has always been used by these government institutions, the same ones who are now, you know, doing CVE, it's typically used against people who are actually standing up for their rights. So it's, you know, been used against, particularly in this country, against Black folks during the civil rights movement, the way that the FBI sort of talked about these organizations and groups who are actually fighting for justice is to label them as radical. So that's another, you know, piece of why this doesn't work. The other part of it is it's always been about Muslims.
But looking at, say, the Obama administration, they were trying to use CVE across a wide range of groups, including, you know, white extremist groups. What was wrong with those programs in terms of trying to address these issues?
Yeah, so the Obama administration may have said that they were trying to use it across the board, and that's how CVE has always been framed. It uses facially neutral language like extremism to really hide what is behind these programs. And so one problem is even when you're including, you know, a few token groups that say that they're fighting white supremacy, that actually just helps to cover the deep problems of this program, which again is that it's not a real way to fight violence. And then it also gives people this idea that, oh, it's equal opportunity, so it's fine.
In your mind, is there any value at all to these countering violent extremism programs?
So the fact that you have institutions like the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Justice, which are both law enforcement institutions, handing out money to community organizations, some of whom are doing great work. That's part of the problem. On the end of the Muslim community, what we're seeing is, oh, we only are getting these resources for things that we desperately need, right? Like we do need resources in our community. We do need mental health support. We do need all of these things, but we're only getting them from law enforcement institutions because we're seen as inherently violent. If you're a young Muslim and you realize, oh, this after-school tutoring program, I'm only getting this because the Department of Homeland Security thinks that I'm a potential terrorist, that is horrific. So there are plenty of community programs that deserve support. It shouldn't be through this framework.
At this point, do you think the entire program that Homeland Security and FBI are funding should be just dumped?
Yes, I think they need to end. And I think we need to actually listen to communities about what they really want and not come at it from a law enforcement perspective.
Fatma Ahmed is the deputy director of the Muslim Justice League in Boston. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Next Sunday marks a grim anniversary in world history, 400 years since the first Africans were enslaved in Virginia. To commemorate the transatlantic slave trade, Ghana has declared a year of return for African descendants everywhere, calling people home whose ancestors were forced onto slave ships hundreds of years ago. The World's Rupa Shenoy has been reporting on the origins and legacy of the slave trade in Ghana. Next week, we'll be hearing her stories about the different ways people see this history.
The last 5 centuries of human history has been marked by sheer brutality and criminality of conduct towards the black man, whose oppression has been rationalized by a systemic institutionalization of the false claim that the black man was inferior to the white man.
Yeah, we just happened
to be here. When
we just got lucky and came
here. Yeah, we're blessed like that.
It's as solemn as it's supposed to be.
I'm from the Caribbean. For me, it marks a time when my ancestors were taken by force from this land. So to come back to where it all began in freedom is a momentous occasion. Yeah, so it's brilliant.
Their great ancestors were the labor force who built the United States.
When people say, well, you know, the Africans had slaves, so, you know, American slavery wasn't that bad, you know, stuff like that. These sorts of things get flattened and used in bad faith arguments to prop up apologism for colonialism and slavery in the West.
They took the brightest, the best, the strongest from this continent. So what would have happened had those people not left this continent? What would this continent be like?
You see, home is home. No matter what happened, we think this is where they belong. They are part of us.
Listen for those stories next week on The World. It's one of the most common words in the English language, T-H-E, the, or the if you prefer. Here's something you might not know about a word we use hundreds of times a day. The, or the folks in Columbus, Ohio, they think they own it. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
People from Ohio State University have a habit of insisting they're from the Ohio State University.
The Ohio State University.
The Ohio State University.
The Ohio State University.
The Ohio State.
And now OSU wants to trademark the word the. If this trademark request is approved, it could have dire consequences for us here at The World. I mean, what would we do? Call ourselves World?
Those stories coming up on World.
That just sounds weird. And while I'm on the topic, we have some pretty intense debates about the word the here in the newsroom.
It's the Gambia.
No, it's Gambia.
No, no. Have you been to the Gambia?
No, I haven't.
I have. And they were very insistent, it's the Gambia.
Why?
I don't know. They said it is.
I'm going to cut it off here. It so happens I dug up an old BBC interview with a linguist who sounds quite sure of himself.
The only two countries in the world where the definite article is absolutely obligatory are the Gambia and the Bahamas. And in the case of the Gambia, when the country was first explored by the Portuguese, they named the country after the river. And the river is the River Gambia. So they called it the Gambia, a Gambia, as it would have been in Portuguese.
Whatever. I'm going to settle this once and for all.
Thank you for calling the Embassy of the Republic of Gambia, the smiling coast of Africa.
Wow. The Republic of Gambia. Didn't see that one coming. In conclusion, the whole definite article thing is confusing. But if you take one thing away from this little speech, it should be this. Ohio State does not own the. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Why didn't wake up this morning? Because you didn't go to bed. You were watching the whites of your eyes turn red. The calendar on your wall is ticking.
That's the band The, and this is The World. Who hasn't gazed out at the ocean and wondered, what would it be like to live at sea? Reporter Noon Saleh in Abu Dhabi has done that.
So I live right across the Corniche, which is this long stretch of beach that lines the city. And every once in a while, I see from my window these beautiful big boats, or dhows.
Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. The city is a marvel of riches, engineering, and architecture, and the boats, or dhows, provide a stark contrast to the sleek, modern city.
They almost look like they belong in another time. So I thought to myself, I was like, you know, what is their story? And so I do a little bit of digging, and I found that there's much more than these historic vessels. That at the harbor where they're docked, there's a whole community of men who for the past 2, 3, 4 decades have lived and worked on these dhows with very little interaction with the city around them.
The sailors are from Gujarat, India. Noon Saleh is a reporter with the podcast Kerning Cultures, which features stories from the Middle East. And she brings us this story about an Indian fishing culture in Abu Dhabi that's coming to an end.
So I went out to the docks. I tried to speak to some of these guys, but I quickly found out that I would need a translator, someone that spoke Gujarati. So I met this lovely translator, Vipruta, or Vips, and she met one of the sailors during this Hindu religious gathering. And that was Ramchandra. Vips and I met Ramchandra at the docks. And he's a smiling, quiet man, short stature. He's impeccably dressed, a white dress shirt and beige slacks. So he leads us up onto the boats. And to get to his boat, it's about the fourth boat down and to the right. You have to physically jump across each boat. And you got to watch out for the gaps between each boat. And you're doing this as the boats all bop up and down to the motions of the waves. So we got to the boat, sat down, started talking to Ramchandra, the boat's captain.
He was 20-year-old when he came here. He came with his uncle.
This is Vipruta. She told me that Ramchandra is the oldest of 6 siblings.
And he had 1 sister and 6 brothers.
He started working as a fisherman in the 10th grade and years later traveled to Abu Dhabi with his uncle.
They came here so that they can support their father because they didn't have enough money so that their younger siblings can go for the studies.
I think it was at the moment that we sat across from Chandra. I found out that later that month, the government was coming down with a rule that would essentially change the way that they fish. And everything that these guys have known for the past 2, 3, 4 decades, these men's livelihoods, the industry itself, it was all coming to an end. All of the men we spoke to were from the same province in India, Gujarat. And it's a place a lot of young men come from to the UAE because it faces the mouth of the Gulf across the Arabian Sea. Because of how far away it is and how expensive it is, they don't get to go home very often, maybe about once a year or so. And they're living and working in the UAE away from their families. So when they speak of home, of Gujarat, their responses are wistful, almost romantic.
He's saying that once he enters his village, it is like it's a heaven for him because it's very clean, fresh air, and that smell of the first rain. So it is like very good.
These guys fish traditionally using something called a gurgur, which is a metal net.
And I see now that he just put some bread in the net. What's that about?
Put some food for the fish.
Yes. Imagine kind of, you know, it's a cage made of wires. And they use it by throwing it into the ocean, into the sea. And it's a very effective way to target kind of a large proportion of fish. They're not super large. They're about, you know, 1/2 meter high, 1/2 meter wide. And they trap fish. Once they come in, they aren't able to go out. What the captains do is they attach a piece of bread, food, to catch the fish, essentially.
Okay, now he's throwing this net in the sea. When they are in the sea, they keep it in the sea for 15 to 20 days.
He's steering the ship with his feet.
Huh?
He's steering it with his feet.
Yeah, because he is doing something with his hands.
Each boat has this elevated portion towards the back of the boat where a cloth-like material serves as kind of a shade overhead. So throughout all the boats, you'll see fishermen kind of gather, sit underneath this makeshift shade, cross-legged, playing cards, napping, chatting. It's quite obviously the coolest spot on the boat under the scorching Abu Dhabi sun. And working conditions here are better than for fishermen back home, they said.
There in India, the water is very deep. Here it is not that deep. And there, they don't have this metal net.
She's talking about the gurgur, which is really good at catching fish. And it's because it's so effective that it's caused overfishing in the UAE. Abandoned gurgurs also pose a huge threat to marine life. Think of lost metal cages trapping fish under the sea, something known as ghost fishing. The Gargours also have been responsible for trapping endangered species because, of course, they don't discriminate what they catch. So the UAE has been trying to address the issue of overfishing for years, enacting a series of laws including placing restrictions on the use of the Gargour. To give you an example of just how serious this problem is, earlier this year, the Environment Agency of Abu Dhabi found that more than 85% of the local favorite, Hamour, had essentially been wiped out and could result in the species' complete extinction in the Arabian Gulf. In the same month I met Ramchandra and his crew while I was sitting atop their boat, the Ministry of Climate Change and Environment issued a resolution banning the use of the Gargour cages. So what I had seen is that they were only using Gargours to fish. So if they didn't have a Gargour, then they really didn't have any other method of fishing. It's really all that they knew how to use.
That's it. This is the last day for your fishing and everything will be closed. Nothing else. That why, what is the reason, when they can start. Nothing they have been informed. So it's just... But they have been hearing from other people that it is maybe because of the harm it is doing to the environment and sea world. It's all in hands of God. So God must have made some other plans for them.
Effective May 1st, 2019, the Gujarati fishermen packed up their few belongings accumulated over the last few decades, photos, clothes, and with their dhow still anchored at the Mina seaport in Abu Dhabi, made their final trip back home to Gujarat. What happens next to Ramchandra and his crew is uncertain. They give me vague answers. Maybe they'll start fishing again in India. Maybe they'll start a small business back home. But they always come back to the similar response. This was God's will, and we'll be all right.
That report came to us from Noon Saleh and the podcast Kerning Cultures. And that's it for us this week. The World's theme music is by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.